Open at 823-1920. And now, here's your host, Jay Davis.
And welcome back to Broadview. The one thing I didn't get to talk about today was Obama, because you did the whole intro here.
I think I talked about him a little too much.
Well,
he's really getting on my nerves.
Well, you know, what about the Greyhound One?
Yeah.
The big bus.
How do you go talking about jobs for Americans and then drive around in a Canadian bus doing it?
Well, I was just going to say, and actually it wasn't even made in America. Yeah. It was made in Canada. Dubbed the Greyhound
One. And we're
One.
Paying for it. That's just, it just grinds me. It's a campaign. Everybody knows it's a campaign thing.
Well, they say that the perception is important, especially in politics. So he needed a big old bus. So even though Obama's new tricked out bus for a 3-day trip in the Midwest was purchased through a U.S. retailer, it was made in Canada. Rumors started swirling this week on the blogs. Nicknamed Greyhound One was not American made, which is ironic considering part of the president's goal of the tour has been to talk about jobs and getting Americans back to work and getting them into making American-made products.
You heard what Romney called it, right?
No.
Obama's magical misery bus tour?
Magical misery, he could
magical
only hope.
Misery,
I'm sure he was having a good time. Says he was brainstorming the heartland to boost U.S. jobs and a taxpayer-financed luxury bus the government had custom-built for him in Canada. That's what the Post said.
Here's how it works. If you're the president, the government pays for the stuff that you have to do as president.
Mm-hmm.
If you start your re-election campaign, then your campaign has to pay for the stuff.
Well, that's why he's saying he's not campaigning.
But he clearly is.
He's not campaigning. He's going out, checking out America and talking with taxpayers about jobs and what he can do. $1.1 million that vehicle was. $1.1 million. And how much to be tricked out? It was Secret Service? Got to be there. They got to, you know what is it? Bulletproof? I mean, of course. I mean, it has to be. It's a VIP H345 model. It's the company's top of the line and used by major traveling rock bands. Face it, he is a rock star. It's the most luxurious model ever, ever, ever. Made by Prevost.
You know what the Huffington Post is, right?
Yeah, of course.
That's the liberal... Mm-hmm. publication that just bought AOL, I think, or they merged with AOL. You know things are bad for Obama when they're turning on him.
What would they say?
They have 7 questions for Obama about this bus tour.
Let's hear it.
You ready to hear it?
Yeah, let's hear them.
This is the Huffington Post.
Okay.
Supposedly his ally.
Yeah.
Number 1, who designed that all-black bus? Darth Vader? Number 2, why did Obama go on a bus tour of America where he encouraged people to buy American in a Canadian bus? We already
I have that question too. Yeah, that's one of my questions.
3. Moreover, why wasn't the bus electric? When he wants all of us to buy electric cars, why is he driving around?
Oh, it's a gas pig.
Yeah,
is that what you're saying?
Pig. Probably gets 2 miles per gallon. Number 4, why isn't Obama's campaign paying for the bus tour? It's obviously a campaign event. Remember,
well, that's
this
what you brought up.
This is the Huffington Post saying this. 5, why is the listening tour over after only 3 days? The talking tour has been going on since he was elected. That's the liberal
but 3 days,
Huffington Post.
But 3 days you're not campaigning.
6, what music do people listen to on the tour bus? My guess is Obama's speeches are on a constant loop. 7, my very favorite Obama line from the bus tour is, I make no apologies for being reasonable. That sounds like a bad job interview response. Is anybody really calling him into question for being reasonable?
Reasonable.
That's the Huffington Post about their president.
What are they going to do with the bus now?
Yeah, what happens to it now?
Now, is this campaign camp going to buy it?
The government now owns it,
I guess.
Yeah,
now they own
so
it.
So you and
what
I...
What are they going to do with it?
To a certain extent, own a big black bus.
We got a piece of that action.
Yeah, we have a piece of that.
Well, Tea Party Ryan Rhodes tried to get a piece of Obama. Did you hear that speech?
Yeah,
in public. He asked Obama about what Biden said. If Biden was calling the Tea Party
terrorists.
Did you see that whole thing? Well, here's my opinion on it. You can tell me what yours is. I mean, it got back and forth, heated conversation back and forth. But as far as I'm concerned, I think it's kind of crazy for him to be asking Obama about something Biden said anyway. I mean, that was just my first thought.
Yeah.
Why is he asking Obama about what Joe Biden said?
Yeah.
Ask Joe Biden.
And Joe Biden says a lot of crazy things.
Yeah, he
it's
does
probably
say
not
a lot of crazy
to,
things.
To hold Obama accountable
but he's,
for him.
He's out of the country now, so he's, you know.
They're keeping him pretty quiet, aren't they?
Yeah.
Every once in a while, though,
Same
he manages to open his mouth. And
yeah. It was pretty interesting. Interview later on Fox News, Rhodes claimed that the president insisted that Biden had not made the original comment, even denying the original comment. He just denied it. Said the vice president didn't make any of those assertions. And he doesn't want, Rhodes felt that he just didn't want to admit it to national TV.
Mm-hmm. So a lot of the debate is about whether it was appropriate to confront the president of the United States like that. Do you think it's appropriate?
I think that was my question. Was it appropriate?
And
why would he ask him what Joe Biden said?
No, I mean,
I think he's just trying to be combative.
So a lot of people are saying that this is the president and you should respect the office, so you should not confront him like that.
Well, no, I think you should. No, I don't think that. I think you should ask Joe Biden, though, about what Joe Biden said. Hmm. I mean, they're grown people, okay?
I kind of fall on that. You know,
I think you should be able to confront the president with any question you have to ask.
Yeah, you can confront him with a question.
In a respectable manner.
Yeah, but it should be in a respectful manner.
But
even if you can't stand the man, like that might be the case with Obama. You still, it's the office, you have to respect it and how you ask the question.
Absolutely, because all they're doing is tearing down future presidents. The office becomes nothing.
Right.
It means nothing. You don't have to respect it, and our children see that.
If we want our presidents to be able to come out in public and go through a crowd and talk to people, then we all have to be respectful.
We have to treat him like a king.
Even if we don't like him. Ask him a pointed question, but ask it in a polite manner.
I think
manner.
It's okay, but I think you can show respect.
Right.
Yes, I think the respect is
important.
I think
he might have crossed the line, and I hate to say that
because so
I'm a big supporter of the Tea Party.
Well, yeah, me too. I'm a big supporter. Ryan Rhodes, I think he's a brilliant man, but I think he stepped over the line, and he looks like a fool to me.
To you.
Yeah, it's my opinion on that. Ask Joe Biden.
Like he's ever going to be allowed out in public.
I know.
Between now and November of 2012.
He's out of the country, and they're keeping him hidden.
They're going to lock him in the basement or
something. Especially now. I was also looking at the history of the rating agency. You know, we were talking about S&P and Moody's and how they really actually acquired the status that they have. How did Wall Street rating agencies begin? How did they get their influence? In case you're wondering. So I looked it up because I was wondering.
Well, this ought to be interesting.
Yes, it started in 1909 when investor John Moody was trying to determine how to tell the public which companies and bonds would be the safest to invest in. He acquired long lists of financial information. He did all of his research about each company, but his lists weren't exactly easy for the general public to understand, as you can well understand. Moody decided that it would be easier for his company to look at each company's financial information and their credit history, and then assign each investment opportunity a rating based on a scale. Is it making any sense so far?
Yeah.
He said, I wonder what would happen if I just gave people a simple device that would boil down to a letter, like start with AAA, which would be the safest, and that would be higher than AA. And then A would go all the way down to D.
AAA, AA, 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 D,
which is kind of like the grades that he gives students in law school, he decided, from an A all the way down to the bottom, D being the default, which was F. In my day.
Hey. And I'll bet you got a few of those.
What makes you say that?
I'm just guessing.
Just what makes you say that? You don't think I was a straight A student?
Were you?
No. I did know the meaning of the word F. But I didn't get a lot of Fs. No. That's failure. No, I didn't get a lot of those. But yeah, anyway. Moody published his information about railroad investments in the book. Any investor looking to buy a railroad bond would purchase his book, and then would know, based on the rating scale, which investments were safest and which were the riskiest for their investments. Now, after the stock market crashed in 1929, the agency began to also rate bond investments for banks, at the request, of course, of the U.S. government. But things began to change in the 1960s and the 70s. Instead of changing investors for their rating information, the agencies began to charge the bond issuers themselves for the ratings, kind of like the Arbitron ratings
mm-hmm.
in radio. Yeah. You get charged, and then you can use them. If you don't pay for them, you can't use them. So people were very critical of this, and they began to create a lot of conflict. Now, you can imagine what the difference between ratings of restaurants and movie night would be if, instead of a Michelin guide or the Zagat guide, whatever that is. If the restaurants or the movie companies themselves were paying the rates and the raters for the rates, it's an obvious conflict of interest. See what I'm saying?
And that's what they're accusing them of now.
And that's what they're accusing them of now. So anyway, they had a hard job of that, figuring out how much capital broker dealers would have to set aside in order to remain safe.
Well, this is a topic of discussion because of what happened in 2008, you know, when it seemed like the rating industry let us down. They didn't tell us.
Well, at that time, the rating agencies were very much the center of the crisis.
Yeah, they weren't telling us that this was going to happen. So what good are they if they can't tell us when the collapse is coming?
They actually enabled and facilitated all of the complex financial instruments that really were at the core of why the markets melted down in 2007, and then in 2008 again. What they did basically was initially rate mortgage-backed securities, the bundles of the prime and the subprime mortgages. And then in a second wave of ratings, they took those mortgage-backed securities and rated the bundles with the bundles, bundling them all, which were called collateralized debt obligations. Basically, they were doing was repackaging those things that were already rated. That's what happened.
And they gave them a high.